From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her new book, the neuroscientist Rachel Herz explores the psychology of eating. That is to say, all the complicated factors that go into the stuff we choose to eat or not eat. The book is about how we perceive taste and flavor, how sweetness can blunt pain and actually make you kinder. It turns out our senses have a profound influence on the way we experience food. Like, take the sense of smell. The smell of certain foods can trigger emotions and can remind us of moments in the past. So in that sense, Herz says food is memory, but it's also emotion, and it's also love. Today in the program, Herz is joining us to explain why we eat what we eat after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's what the neuroscientist Rachel Herz says about food in her new book. Food is an aesthetic immersion. So it's not just sustenance, though it is that. And it's not just comfort, though it can be that. Food is so much. Food is who we are. That's another thing she says in the book. It's memory and emotion and fear and disgust and guilt. Basically, her book is an exploration of the psychology of eating. And if that sounds too squishy, there's plenty of physiology in here too, like how food affects our minds and our bodies. In fact, she says the experience of eating is an extraordinary interplay between the two. Herz's book is called Why You Eat What You Eat, and she joined us yesterday from a studio in Providence, Rhode Island, to talk about it. She told us for some reason, ever since she can remember, she had been infatuated with the sensation of food.
Well, I think I've always been sort of a sensory person. I mean, and with respect to food, I have an abiding memory of my mother telling me to stop squeezing the bread. So sort of having to touch things and, you know, having to hold things, smell things. You know, I was always extremely curious in the kitchen. My mother was a very good cook. We had lots of spices and lots of things to explore, you know, even trying the dog biscuit, you know, whatever the case might be. I don't think I had any fear of exploration when it came to food. And just, I mean, I love to food and I love to eat. So it seemed like a natural extension of that.
You mentioned your abiding memory. It seems like their memory comes up a lot in this book, the idea that food is very much related to memory. And it's something, that connection, maybe that's part of your interest, I guess, as a cognitive neuroscientist, how our minds change the perceptions. And memory is so much a part of that, it seems.
Well, absolutely. And also what my major focus of expertise and research has been with respect to the sense of smell is how aromas bring back memories and how those memories are different and special from memories that are triggered in any other way. And so I have a really sort of deep understanding and interest in that. And food, given that it is so much about aroma, because taste, as you would discover in this book, is really, even though we use taste to mean everything to do with what we experience when we eat, it's really technically only refers to the salt, saltiness, sourness, sweetness, and bitter of what we have in our mouth. And for instance, what you're experiencing when you eat bacon is the aroma of the bacon plus the taste of salt. And so aroma in and of itself is such a deeply connective and evocative experience that is, you know, what really leads through the book, I guess, in a thread. And then how comfort food is connected to memory and how aromas are connected to memory and so on.
I guess it's obvious why food would alter our physiology. I mean, that makes sense, of course. But why would food affect our mood and our behavior? Why would that be?
Well, because food, I mean, the tastes of specific food. So, for instance, sweet is really interesting because just the taste of sweet itself can actually make you happy. Even if you don't particularly have a special sweet tooth, tasting sweet for everybody initiates a pleasurable response. It is hardwired into us to love sweet. It turns on the bliss points in our brain. It releases neurotransmitters associated with reward and pleasure. And it actually makes us feel happy, even if it's only briefly. And it also makes us nicer to other people. So in terms of our behavior, it actually can change behavior, at least in the short term, by making us more generous and more benevolent. And as a tip, if you ever have an important presentation or a meeting where you want people to agree with each other, and especially with you, if you bring sweets to that meeting, you will get everyone in a happier, more cooperative mood.
Yeah. But why would nature select for sweetness? Because it packs a good caloric wallop for us. It's good for us in that basic sense, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, so sweetness is a signal for carbohydrates from a nature taste perspective, and we need to be consuming carbohydrates. They're the easiest calories to find, and they're definitely highly important from the point of view of keeping us alive and many of our metabolic systems. Another thing is that saltiness is also a taste that we inherently like, and saltiness is a signal for protein. So that is another positive. We need that macronutrient. Fat, although it's not a taste, it's a feeling that we find extremely pleasurable, and fat is also very, very important for us to consume in the landscape of not having massive amounts of food around us all the time. And bitter, by contrast, is a taste that we are programmed to dislike, because bitter tends to mean poison in nature. And even though there are bitter leafy greens that are good for us, it's better to avoid bitter overall, because bitter can kill you.
Yeah. Well, bitter also, and we'll get back to this, can change your moral outlook, as you put it. But let's hold off on that for a moment, because I wanted to lay some groundwork first. You say right up front in the book that taste and smell were the first senses to evolve. You also mentioned that, unlike our sense of vision, which takes a few years to develop, that our senses of taste and smell are functional well before we are born. Talk a little bit about that. They're the first to evolve. They're the first senses that we really connect to as humans.
Yes. So the idea of taste and smell, basically, they're the chemical sensing systems.
Yeah.
And the ability to detect chemicals in the environment is what every organism on this planet can do. And from the most simple-celled amoebas on up to the most complex creatures, this was the primary sensory system to negotiate the landscape around. So when a little single-celled bacteria, or whatever the case might be, is moving along in its medium and it can detect another chemical close to it, that means it's good. So I better, munch on that, or it's bad, it might munch on me.
Right.
That would be the basic approach and avoid mechanism, which is directly connected to the chemicals that are in that environment.
So taste is basically elicited by chemicals. So so the perception of taste is mirrored by this underlying biochemical reaction. That's what taste is?
Yes. So taste are the ability to detect chemicals in aqueous solutions. So, for instance, in saliva and, other things that we can eat. Smell is the ability to detect chemicals in things that are in the air. So it's volatile. So we have to be able to inhale the chemicals for the point of view of smell. And we have chemicals that are in our mouth that are being detected by receptors in our mouth for the sense of taste. So they're both geared towards detecting chemicals, just chemicals presented in different ways, and actually different types of chemicals. So you can't smell salt, and you can't taste the aroma of bacon.
Yeah. So how do humans experience taste differently from other creatures if they do? Like my pet dog, for example. If I throw him a piece of barbecue brisket from the table, does he sense the same thing that I do? The smoke layer and the kind of juicy fatness. Does he experience it in the same kind of way I do?
Well, he experiences the same sense that you do directly in terms of which particular odorants are in that. He probably can smell them much more acutely than you. Not
right.
Probably, I'm sure. He can smell them much more acutely than you. He may also be picking up things that you cannot directly pick up because the intensities are so low. He can't probably detect things that you can't detect at all, because it's been shown that actually humans have the capacity to detect any chemical that is conceivably able to be smelled. It just depends on the intensity of that in order for us to be able to apprehend it. Mm. So you and your dog are perceiving the same odorants, but your responses to them could be different quite vastly as a function of your associations to them. So dogs have some instinctive responses to certain smells. Humans actually do not have instinctive responses to smells per se. Our responses to smells are learned through our experience with them.
Hmm. This idea that I think everyone has seen that map of the tongue where, okay, this is the part where the salty is, and this is where we experience sour on the tongue, and this is sweet, and this is bitter. Is that pretty much just nonsense?
So unfortunately, this idea of the tongue map is a myth that was propagated as a function of the fact that it's a really nice, simple drawing and very easy to explain and easy to keep representing. It has nice little colors. You can show kids. You can show college students. Everyone seems to think this is, like, you know, makes sense, as it were.
Yeah.
But it actually is untrue. You can detect every tastant, so salt, sour, sweet, bitter, everywhere on your tongue pretty much equally. And where this idea came from, unfortunately, was a misinterpretation of a originally German experiment that was conducted in the early 1900s. And in the 1950s, a Harvard professor, Edward Boring was his name, in fact, read the original German. And there was, I'm not sure if he translated it or someone else had translated, but anyway, there was an error in the translation.
Wow.
And the idea that there were these sort of different locations for different sensitivities arose from that. And the idea of this beautiful, simple diagram of a tongue map came directly from there. Interestingly, in the early, mid-1970s, somebody else, Catherine Collins, actually redid the original experiments, found that they were wrong, found that you could taste everything everywhere on your tongue. But unfortunately, her changing of this fact has not really seeped into our common understanding nearly as well as it should. And so I am there for advocating the tongue map is wrong. You can taste everything everywhere on your tongue.
Except for the center line.
Yes, the center line is taste blind, interestingly. Yeah. You cannot, if you put your finger in salt water and you dabbed it just right in the middle of your tongue, you couldn't taste it. But interestingly, the roof of your mouth has taste receptors. So if you stuck your salty finger on the roof of your mouth, you would actually get a little sting of saltiness.
Wow. So basically, our mouth detects these chemicals, but our brain is telling us the difference. It's the brain that's making this perception. Yes?
Yes, exactly. Because we actually, the taste receptors that are in our mouth are the only ones that are hooked up to the taste cortex in the brain. So that is to say that, you know, you're eating a Danish and it tastes sweet and it's in your mouth and your brain is like, yes, yummy, delicious sweetness. But you have taste receptors elsewhere in your body. So for instance, in your pancreas or your liver, if you're a man, in your testicles, and those taste receptors are not telling you anything tastes sweet or salty. Those taste receptors are responding to the chemicals that are tastants, but they're not telling the brain that something tastes sweet. Mm. And the interesting thing about bacon, if just going back to that for a second, if I can maybe just clarify what
sure,
I said earlier,
sure.
is when I said you can't taste bacon per se, you can't detect the aroma, as it were, through your taste receptors. But because we eat food and food takes place in our mouth, the brain knits together the sensations of smelling the bacon with the taste of the salt. And so it seems as if you are tasting the smell of bacon, but actually they're coming through different routes, because when we breathe in while we're chewing, the odorous molecules from what we're eating come into the nose through an opening at the back of the mouth.
So this was interesting. You mentioned that there are pharmaceutical companies that are working to develop drugs that change our perception of certain, I guess, certain flavors. Like if kale, you said, tasted more like candy, would we eat more of it? Or if we could somehow make chocolate eclairs somehow taste bitter, would that deter people from, you know, overeating? Would you talk a little bit about this, just how drugs could eventually change our perceptions of certain flavors?
Yeah, so this is research that actually comes out of working with rodents and looking at the fact that we have a tongue map, as it were, in our brains. That is to say that there are areas in the brain, in the taste cortex, which are responsive to sweet or bitter or salty and so forth. And by stimulating those areas of the taste cortex, you could actually make an animal think, for instance, that the bitter food that it was just given was sweet as well, or, you know, changing things all around and making the sweet things seem aversive and so forth. So there are technically ways, if drug companies could manipulate this somehow, or if we could have little implants in our brains, for making a disconnect between what we actually have on our tongue and what our brains are interpreting that sensation as being like. So that even though the taste receptors on the tongue for sweet were being activated, if in the brain the area for bitter was being stimulated at that same time, you would find that aversive. Now, this currently is science fiction.
Yeah, I was going to say, how close are we to that? That's so interesting.
I actually have no idea how close we are in reality. I don't know what the secrets of the pharmaceutical world is are up to.
Yeah.
But, I mean, certainly, you know, the whole diet industry is, you know, multi-billions of dollars within any pharmaceutical company. And to sort of figure out how to rein in our appetite, somehow, you know, develop diet pills that are safe for us, but would be, you know, some incredible holy grail. Mm. And the degree to which one could do that just by manipulating taste is really fascinating. I don't know where we are in the real trajectory of that.
Yeah. That's Rachel Herz. She's a neuroscientist and an expert on the connection between psychology and our sense of smell. Her new book is called Why You Eat What You Eat. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the psychology of eating. That is to say, the things that influence what we eat and what we don't. Rachel Herz is a neuroscientist who explores how food affects us mentally and emotionally. Her book is called Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. This is interesting, and we'll dig into this more as we go, but you say that the sensation of taste can reveal past experiences, but also alter our moods and even influence our moral judgments. Say something about that. Let's talk about sweet, for example. Sweets, you say, can make you kinder. Now, there was this research project, I think it was in North Dakota and Pennsylvania, that connected eating sweets with actually being kind, being sweet as a person.
Right. So this was a big study. There were six different experiments within the study examining how the taste of sweet influenced perception of other people, their people's own moods, and actually their behavior in a variety of different ways. And it was found that tasting sweet made people happier and kinder and nicer and more agreeable, and that not only from the point of view of how they felt, but actually from the point of view of how they acted. So they were more altruistic and generous after eating something sweet compared to after eating something that was like a plain cracker or tasting water or something like this. So the idea being that sweet per se actually activates a feeling of happiness, and it actually makes the reward area of the brain light up, and it does feel innately good to taste sweet. So we are feeling happy, and we are sort of, you know, in a pleasure state when we taste sweet. And so this translates also to how we feel. And it's also the case that there's kind of a little sort of folkloric aspect of, you know, people who eat sweets, people tend to think that they are sweeter, but it turns out that they actually are a little kinder. So people who have, you know, the proverbial sweet tooth are actually rated by other people as being somewhat nicer than people who don't like sweet so much.
And then what about sour? This was so interesting how the sour taste, for example, it seems to come and go depending on what's happening. Like it diminishes after we exercise. And if we're depressed or agitated, it can be more intense, if I get that right.
Yes. So this is to do – so you're exactly right. So when we're depressed, unfortunately, this is another thing. So relating to sweetness, you know, sweet is something that's a pleasurable sensation for us all, regardless of how much of a sweet tooth we have. But when we're depressed, sweet doesn't taste as sweet. And so I mean, this is where there's sort of a little double-edged sword of people who turn to comfort foods, and especially if your comfort food tends to be in the sweet domain, mm-hmm. if you're depressed, you're not only going to want your sweet comfort food, but you're going to need more of your sweet comfort food to even feel that hedonic high, as it were, from eating it, because sweetness is dulled. Whereas sour tastes are more intense when people are stressed or depressed. And so this has to do with the neurotransmitters that are involved in mediating our sensation of those experiences and how being stressed, you know, increases some, decreases others, whereas being happy has the opposite effects, basically.
I have to say, one of the most fascinating connections here was the section about bitterness and the idea of kind of our moral judgments, how they're affected by this. So the kind of taster you are is related to your emotional sensitivity and personality in some way. And there was this one study you write about where these, I guess they were super tasters, that they would feel more anger after watching a rape scene in a movie than people who tasted differently, non-tasters or people who had just normal tasting sensations. That would you talk a little bit about this in the sense that how bitterness could change our moral outlook? Like, explain that if you would.
Yeah. So interestingly, the emotion of disgust is highly connected to our feelings of moral injustice. And people often use the word disgust to evoke a sense of moral, you know, disgrace and so forth. So when we eat something that is bitter, and the taste of bitter is fundamentally related to the emotion of disgust, and it's believed that the origin of the emotion of disgust is, in fact, based in the rejection of bitter taste. So this is this oral food-based emotion that has to do with rejecting poison incorporation from the point of view of the taste, which is usually a signal for something poison, you know, bringing something poison from the outside into the body, and then is sort of extrapolated and magnified psychologically by getting rid of or avoiding the poison that's outside in sort of the psychological environment or the social environment and making sure it doesn't infiltrate. And so there is this sort of fundamental theoretical or philosophical intersection with bitterness and morality and the emotion of disgust. And it works such that people who, when they taste something bitter, are actually more morally judgmental. So again, in the short term, just like sweetness temporarily makes people nicer and more generous, tasting something bitter makes people more morally judgmental and more sort of condemning overall as sort of a trait against other people. And so it's sort of an antisocial, the taste that actually creates an antisocial response.
Wow.
As compared to sweetness, which seems to create a social response.
There was this experiment you write about, I think this was the University of Illinois, and they asked they got these committed Christians together, and they wanted them to read a few things and then explain what they thought about. So read something and then tell us, taste this diluted lemon drink and tell us how it tastes. And in other words, the way they perceived the thing that they were reading had an effect on the way they described the thing that they, this lemon drink. Did I get that right?
So this is this really, what you're tapping into is what I think is one of the really fascinating things you can learn from this book is how there's this bidirectional interaction. So tasting something sweet can make you nicer, tasting something bitter can make you more morally judgmental. And feeling more morally judgmental, for instance, or more sort of scandalized or whatever the case might be, or nicer or in a winning mood or whatever, sort of your emotional state also affects your taste perception. And in the experiment you're talking about, so they had committed Christians reading Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion.
Yeah.
And they were feeling upset and morally affronted after having read this. Yeah. And so then their perception of something which had a sour, possibly like more kind of unpleasant taste, but it was mixed in with other things. It was like a kind of Gatorade-like drink. So it had sourness. It had some other taste as well. Was much worse than if they had read something that was advocating their moral and religious beliefs.
Mm. Throughout the book, you tell these various stories of people who have these diverse relationships with food. And I wanted to go through some of these. Let's start with Gabriel. Fascinating character. He is afflicted with this thing called, I hope I get this right, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, which makes him just incredibly, I guess, picky about food.
Exactly. So this is a disorder that tends to appear in children probably around the age of three, and it is labeled by the DSM-5 now, ARFID, or what you just said, Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. ARFID is the acronym. And it is, you know, extremely severe picky eating, but now classified as sort of a psychiatric psychological condition.
Yeah.
And Gabe had this really severe form of it. Most kids have a little bit of it, and they tend to grow out of it completely. Some kids have it to a certain degree, and then they, you know, maybe stick with being less experimental when they're adults. And some kids, like Gabe, have it in an extremely severe way, where they're really, their diet is sort of frighteningly restricted, and they refuse to eat almost everything except for maybe, let's say, a few specific white foods. And they have all kinds of issues about foods can't touch each other. There's, you know, there's a whole set of things that food is really perceived, and actually really interestingly going back to discuss, as really being repulsive. And talking to Gabe about this directly, he's a real person, explained how interestingly he wasn't particularly disgusted by other things. So that is to say, he didn't find the idea of, let's say, putting a dirty sock in his mouth to be repulsive. But the idea of eating something unknown, you know, again, incorporating that into his body, you know, swallowing whatever that strange thing would be, was absolutely terrifying and awful to him. And he actually couldn't understand how everyone else seemed to be so blithely fine with doing it. And this was seriously deeply embedded in him. And, you know, all the screaming by his father aside, that would not make him eat any more than he was going to in the first place. And he was, you know, very, very thin and very, very unhappy for most of his childhood. And slowly, fortunately, was able to have some experiences and some realizations which made him a bit more amenable towards food, and very, very gradually becoming able to eat some more things. Although he's still very restricted, he is feeling like he has more potential for having a more normal relationship with food.
You say he's on the road to recovery, I think, in the book.
Yes.
Getting better. Well, let's talk more about the fear of food, because you write that we all vary in how easily we can be swayed to try new foods. And there's this thing called, is it neophobia?
Exactly. Yep.
It's, and there's a kind of, it's this fear of food, and there's a scale. Talk a little bit about that, because I guess all of us have some fear of some foods. We're all on some part of this spectrum, I guess.
Yeah. So neophobia literally is fear of the new, and it is used specifically with respect to food. And as I said, you know, this emerges in early childhood and is, in fact, adaptive at a low level. So you don't want to be, as a little youngster toddling around, especially, you know, again, thinking about more of our evolutionary landscape, maybe not having helicopter parents being so available to make sure that you don't stick everything into your mouth. You want to be a little judicious about what you're putting in your mouth. And so you probably want to just stick with what you know. So I'm only going to deal with what I know, what's familiar. I've already eaten this before. And so eating familiar foods are okay, but eating novel foods are not so okay. But as your food repertoire expands, and then going into, you know, the society culture we lived in today, and the fact that actually a much more varied diet is much healthier than a diet that's very restricted to only a few different foods. Mm. So the idea of sort of dropping the neophobia as you become more aware and have more of an understanding and more exposure to different foods and understand what's safe and what isn't safe and so forth.
Yeah.
And then having a varied diet is the good, healthy thing to do. But people do, from the point of view of having this sort of basic personality trait, which we all are different with respect to our personalities, and this seems to be something which is largely ingrained, so innate, that is, we can have experiences which change us, but we also have our sort of our own personal innate genetic profile. And the degree to which you are neophobic and how that translates through your whole life is one of those factors. That is something that you are more or less born with, but you can shift through your experiences and also your desires. But you're still, if you're someone who's neophobic, not as severely as gay, but maybe, you know, moderately so, probably still in adulthood, not going to be leaping at the first opportunity to try the new ethnic restaurant that just opened up.
Yeah, yeah. You write about these psychological taste aversions, and they're so interesting. My wife, for example, she got sick one year on a really bad oyster, and it put her off. oysters for years. I mean, I think she's eventually coming back to it. But that seems – that's one thing, and that makes sense just as an adaptive thing. Like, oh, oysters, that's not good. That's not going to be appealing to me, at least for a while. But that seems different from the story you tell about a colleague of yours who said that his favorite meal was ruined when he thought all of a sudden that it just looked like lard or something. Would you talk a little bit about these taste aversions that we have?
Yeah, so exactly what you said. So your wife's aversion to oysters on the basis of having been violently ill after eating one is exactly what we're built to avoid. So these, you know, learned taste aversions, which can take place after just one bad encounter, you know, from the point of view of, again, sort of evolutionary biology, if you ate something and it made you sick, don't eat it again. And we're, you know, and remember to not eat it again. Don't forget next week and, oh, oysters, that would be nice to try. So that's something that's completely sensible and does seem to persist for a very long time. And interestingly, again, although we obviously know what an oyster looks like and, you know, oysters have other characteristics, you know, they're slimy and so forth, but it's really the, you know, other things other than taste per se, because it's not like your wife became averse to anything salty.
Of course.
So it's like the oyster specifically. But what's really interesting is that you can actually, unfortunately, create, because I think we're so built to have this mechanism be there to help protect us from poisoning ourselves, that this can even happen psychologically. So you can do it to yourself, like this colleague of mine, barramundi, which is this soft whitefish that he loved. And then one day, for whatever perverse reasons, he decided it looked like lard when it was on the plate in front of him, and that disgusted him. And then he said he couldn't eat it anymore. And or somebody telling you something terrible, like, you know, that pea soup you're eating looks like snot or something like that.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, my God, I can't eat this.
Yeah.
And to a degree, it depends on how susceptible or suggestible you are. But Elizabeth Loftus also did some really interesting research connected to this, and she's famous for, amongst other things, looking at the unreliability of eyewitness testimony and how you can have these implanted memories and false memories and so forth. And she did a study where she had people believe, as a function of false feedback they got, that when they were children, they had gotten sick on strawberry ice cream. And then she gave them a food rating questionnaire. And she'd already given them one before this little implanted memory of the ice cream thing came along. Mm-hmm. And she found that just by inserting this subtle, you know, belief information, that's something that you, you know, ostensibly probably couldn't remember because it was fake in the first place. Although, interestingly enough, a number of the participants in the study said, oh, yeah, I remember that time. So this is also a testament to how easily fake news can be created.
Yep.
But in any event, these people who were given that information rated strawberry ice cream as much less pleasant than people who had not been given that feedback, and also than how they rated strawberry ice cream beforehand when they hadn't been, you know, subjected to this manipulation. Mm. So we're very, very susceptible to having this take place. And I think, like I said, because it's more adaptive to avoid rather than, you know, oh, it's too bad I didn't get to eat that strawberry ice cream. Mm.
Let's talk about another one of the characters in the book, Stan. This was, I think, in 2006. Stan was struck by a kind of a crazy former employee. Hits him in his truck, a pickup truck. And it's a serious injury. And through the process, he loses his sense of smell. And it's interesting because, I mean, you would think that, of course, it's not a good thing to lose your sense of smell, but you wouldn't think it could, in some ways, kind of ruin your life. And for Stan, it absolutely rocked his life.
Yeah, so this was based on a case where I was an expert witness, and I've dealt with a number of people along these lines. And, you know, it is really incredibly devastating. Not that it happens to absolutely everyone, but people who weren't even aware that their sense of smell really was playing this enormous role in everything that had to do with their existence, who become, unfortunately, overly aware of it when they lose their sense of smell in a traumatic injury, such as in the case of Stan, he was run over by an enraged ex-employee. And fortunately, in some senses, the only thing that happened was this, you know, head injury, which led to his losing his sense of smell. But the fact is that although we tend to think, well, our sense of smell is, well, obviously, as I've just explained, you know, aroma and, you know, loving the taste or the flavors of foods and so forth. And, you know, maybe people think about, you know, being able to smell danger like gas or something like that. Mm-hmm. But actually, our sense of smell is connected to absolutely everything. It is, as I mentioned before, really deeply connected to our emotional and memory life. It's connected to our sense of self. Mm. It's connected to our social relationships. It's connected to our sexual interactions with other people. And depending upon the kind of person you are, when you lose that, it can really spiral you down a rabbit hole. And the other thing with respect to depression is that because the part of the brain where emotion is processed and the part of the brain where smell is processed are fundamentally interconnected and actually the same to a certain extent, when one part of that system malfunctions, it affects the other. So losing the sense of smell actually creates a negative impact on the area of the brain where emotion is processed. And that sort of leads to this continuing deterioration of emotional life in certain individuals especially. And that can just keep on going to a worsening and worsening depression.
It's interesting you write about, you mentioned the king of aromas, which is bacon, of course. But this was interesting. You say that we are not born hardwired to like or dislike any given smells. So is that a cultural thing, our affection for certain aromas?
The short answer is yes. Huh. Yes, it's cultural, and yes, it's our own personal idiosyncratic experiences. Yeah. So just to sort of back up a tiny bit. So with respect to smell, again, going into the evolutionary argument, we are what are known as generalists in terms of species, and that is to say that we can inhabit any locale on the planet, and anything could be food, and anything could be predator potentially from the point of view of what is around us. And so we don't want to be born hardwired to know, you know, sniff, 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 that fishy smell is food, or and nothing else is, or sniff, 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 that bamboo is food and nothing else is. Unlike, for instance, specialist species like
koalas, a panda.
Pandas.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So since we can potentially eat everything, we need to learn in our specific locale, okay, this smell means poisonous mushroom, but maybe if I live somewhere else, that smell could be connected to nutritious food. So I need to learn that based on my own experience. And our own experiences connected with culture, because often we don't need to necessarily get sick first. We hope that culture tells us, you know, eat this, don't eat that, and, you know, we'll all be happy. And the fact that cuisine is such also a very culturally identified and culturally diverse aspect of humanity means that different cultures have different foods and different tastes that they – well, tastes, I'm using it wrong now.
I get it. Yeah.
Different flavors that they particularly enjoy, and different kind of culinary orientations which give their specific set of foods. I mean, there's a lot of identity involved with cuisine and so forth. So if you've grown up with a certain kind of cuisine and this is what you eat, it defines you versus them and so forth. So liking or disliking, I mean, I think one of the greatest examples of this is cheese. So Westerners tend to love cheese. It can be anything from a comfort food to an extreme delicacy. And Asians tend to despise cheese. Yeah. And it's specifically the aroma in both cases that is, you know, really appealing or really disgusting. And this has nothing to do with the nutritional aspects of the food. It has to do with just what you think it is and what it means to you. And another really good example, which is, you know, much closer to home, is the smell of wintergreen in the U.S. versus in the U.K. Right. In Britain, the smell of wintergreen mint is used in medicine and in toilet cleaning products. In the U.S., it's in candy and mints and gum and that sort of thing. And so we know it as something connected to sweet, which is innately good, and a treat, which is also good.
Yeah.
And people in Britain know it as medicine and cleaning the bathroom, which is not very good.
Right.
And so you get these totally disparate responses to these aromas. And this goes, you know, I can give you a multitude of examples. The one sort of caveat to this is if you smell something that also stings at the same time, because when we smell, we also feel. So like when you're smelling ammonia, that burns the inside of your nose too, because that's activating a different system called the trigeminal system. So when we're smelling something that also hurts, because it's activating this trigeminal system, which is also what's activated when we're eating hot peppers and makes our mouth burn, and when we're chopping onions, it makes us tear. So if we're experiencing this sort of pain at the same time, that can make us not like an aroma right away. But it's not the smell per se. It's because it's, you know, creating this other sensation through this other system.
Mm. That's Rachel Herz. Her book is Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Rachel Herz. Her book is called Why You Eat What You Eat. You tell the story about your best friend growing up who was Chinese, and her father said he never felt full unless he had eaten, unless rice was in the meal. And this kind of gets us into the research that you write about for what food satisfies our sense of hunger. Talk a little bit about what's going on here, because this is kind of about familiarity, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that was sort of surprising to me when I was doing research for this book was that, you know, there wasn't some kind of an index that everyone could agree on, like eating this food is really filling and satisfying. And if you eat that, you know, it's not the case. In fact, this research, to the extent that it exists, is very new, only within the last couple of decades. And it's also very varied, like, you know, different studies find different things. But one of the really interesting sort of bottom lines from the research is that foods that we're more familiar with are more satiating than foods that we're not familiar with. And so from the point of view of my friend's father, you know, eating rice was a staple part of, you know, main meals for him. And so, you know, lunch and dinner, there was always rice. And so that signified that was the meal. I feel full. I've had enough. But when, as in the example in the book, that the family would sometimes go to like a chicken barbecue kind of a restaurant where there was no rice, you'd get some potato and a bun along with your barbecue chicken, he never felt that he'd been properly fed, even right. though probably there were more calories in that meal than his normal meal that had rice in it. And so the idea that because there was this, you know, missing this familiar element made it such that the meal did not feel satiating. And this happens to be the case when we eat things that we're not very familiar with from the point of view of our regular routine. We don't have that psychological sense of meal fulfillment, and it tends to make us feel less full and satiated.
I also like this section where you write about rituals, how the rituals of eating increases our pleasure with the experience. And just makes us more personally involved with our food, which is kind of a theme in the book in some ways, being more aware of our food and connected to it.
Yes, absolutely. So you hit that nail right on the head. So being engaged with food is critical to our enjoyment with it. So if we're paying attention, we're involved, we're really sort of we're savoring the flavor, that's really the key. And that is really what makes the meal or whatever we're eating much more pleasurable than if we're distracted, if we're doing other things, if we're not paying attention to the food in the same way, if we're just, you know, eating so quickly we're hardly getting any sensation. And so what's interesting about doing a ritual is that it's, first of all, it slows people down and it engages them in the act of eating. And there were some simple experiments that were done which people just had to do, you know, not anything meaningful behind the ritual, but just sort of a series of little things before they ate, like, you know, and a prescribed set of things. So let's say before you eat the chocolate bar, you're going to break it in half. And then first you're going to unwrap one half and then you're going to unwrap the other. And then you're going to start to eat versus not doing that and just, you know, open the chocolate bar, eat it however you want to. Yeah. Or, you know, maybe just doing something random now or doing something else later. And not only did it make chocolate bars taste better when you did a ritual prior to eating it, it even made carrots taste better and be more enjoyable.
Right.
So anything you eat, if you're engaged, is really the idea, with it, can become more enjoyable. And I think, you know, we do have within our culture certain events where we do have rituals around eating. And birthdays are one, sort of the birthday cake idea, that when, you know, bringing out the cake and people are singing to you and you have all those candles and you have to blow out the candles and make a wish and then you have to cut other people's slices and then you finally get yours. So that piece of birthday cake is really better than eating that same cake in any other way. And sort of the message here is that if you are engaged with your food, then you're going to get more pleasure and satisfaction out of it.
Okay, so I wanted to, because the Super Bowl just happened on Sunday, for those Patriots fans, let's talk about them. How did they eat on Monday that may compare to the Eagles fans and what they ate on Monday?
Yeah, so this is funny because I don't know, you probably don't know this, but I wrote a blog on Psychology Today about this thing, and I wrote it on Friday.
Oh, really?
Of last week, yes. Yeah. And I, like everyone else, I mean, I live in Rhode Island, so I was expecting the Patriots to win.
Yep.
And I wrote about how the Eagles fan would be eating on the basis of the fact that I was presuming they would lose. But in fact, that's not what happened at all. So the idea behind it is doesn't matter. Patriots, Eagles is really irrelevant. It's the point that it's a big game and you're rooting for your home team. So during the game, everybody's eating a lot of chicken wings and everything else. Doesn't matter what the score is. But if your team loses, and especially, and this is research that was done over, this is based on research that was done over two NFL seasons and tracked people who were living in major metropolitan areas, also looked at the differences between really committed fans versus, you know, fair weather fans, and also teams which were like serious rivals versus, you know, not so much, and, you know, the importance of the game and so forth. So the Super Bowl is like the classic example here.
Right.
And if your team loses, and if you're a really dedicated fan, on the day after the game, so on Monday, you eat much more high calorie, not good for you food than if your team wins. And in fact, if your team wins, then compared to your normal diet, you eat a more healthy diet in general. So
and
this is sort of, again, it's connected to the whole comfort food concept. So the feeling of failure, first of all, doesn't have to be our own failure. It can be vicarious failure, and sports are great sort of places for people to put their vicarious senses of victory and loss. Mm-hmm. And so people feel their own sense of dejection when their team loses, especially if they're very committed to the sport. And as a result, they turn to comfort food as a way to sort of soothe that pain. Mm-hmm. And comfort food tends to be high calorie, high fat, usually not highly nutritious foods. So that is why there is much more consumption of that kind of food on that day after, when you're sort of drowning your sorrows, as it were. But interestingly, that during the fall, you know, the next couple of days, so on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and so on, people who were eating tons of pizza and nachos in New England on Monday were not eating only salads on Tuesday and Wednesday. They were eating, you know, their regular food. So not, you know, counterbalancing at all.
Yeah.
So if your team, in the extrapolation would be that if you have a team that you're really dedicated to and they're imploding over the course of the season, you should be careful about how you're eating.
Yeah. Let me, I loved the idea that food is love. It's something that you write about. And you say that, let me quote you from the book. You say that just as our physical bodies crave salt at certain times, our psychological self craves emotional replenishing during times of distress. Talk a little bit about that, how food is quite literally psychological comfort.
Yeah, so this is where comfort food has this emotional connection, and the aromas of comfort food and the meaning of the food connected to times when you were feeling loved and secure in your past with family or with friends, and how it can stand in as a substitute for that when you are feeling distressed or sad. And so comfort food really has more to it than just the fact that it, you know, feels good and tastes good while you're eating it in that moment. It can really feel like a warm hug from the people who make you feel warm and secure and comforted. And so thinking about food in that way shows that food can really act in a very embracing manner, and that food can really represent love. And in fact, also when we are in love, food tastes better to us. So this is connected to the sort of happy mood and sweetness, and and also the fact that there's been research which has shown that love in and of itself sort of increases the pleasure of consumption of food. And so food is love in a variety of different ways, and it can make us feel loved.
I had a conversation with writer Charles Bowden years ago related to the death penalty. And he said he had sort of taken note of people on death row and the meals that they chose for their last meal before they were executed. And he said the thing he noticed was it wasn't that they were going for fancy food or, you know, elite gourmet food. They were going for the familiar, stuff that would take them back, he said, to their childhood and remind them of another time before, you know, their lives got messed up. I guess what you've learned in your book can make sense of what Bowden was saying.
Absolutely. That fits perfectly with this idea. So, you know, at the most distressing point of your life, I'm sure, the night before you're about to be executed, I couldn't imagine anything worse. Feeling the need for that warm hug from the past would be the most thing that you could possibly want on Earth. And so that would be the way that you could get it. And that makes complete sense to me, that it would be those comfort foods from childhood that people would yearn for, to bring them back to that place and time, you know, one last time.
Let me ask you this finally. You write about going to this International Society of Neurogastronomy. And there at this gathering, there were chefs who were there, and they were talking about, you say, about the need to be engaged in this dialogue with diners. And this idea of giving food back its true wonder. Again, this gets at a theme in the book, the idea of engaging with food. Would you say something about that finally?
Yeah, so this was actually very refreshing that these were, you know, very high caliber chefs that were actually recognizing the need that they were cooking for diners who were actually going to be eating their food, and not for themselves or not for fellow chefs and not for some competition or for some esoteric, you know, artistic reason. And so that they needed to understand what their diners wanted, and not also just in elite, expensive gourmet restaurants, but in any context, what that relationship between the chef and the eater was, and what each was going to bring to the table, as it were, and how best to satisfy what the diner would want, and why, and where, and when, and so on. And to have this in people's minds when they were creating food for other people, and this is, you know, even if you're making food at home for your loved ones, or if you're having a special dinner party for, you know, a particular group of people, when you're creating the menu for that, thinking about who you're making that menu for, what will make them feel good, what would they specifically want, and how can you bring yourself into that in a way to create this sort of really intimate relationship, and also a very positive, pleasing relationship, and that it's this really interesting two-way street.
Yeah, it's the emotions we experience that give food the connection. So take into account the emotions when you're making a meal.
Exactly. And the emotions even that you're feeling while you're preparing food can transform what you're preparing right then.
It's Rachel Herz. Her new book is called Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. She joined us from a studio in Providence, Rhode Island. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Claire Jones. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.